VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Many of us who look up at the stars in the night sky often wonder if there is, somewhere out in the cosmos, another Earth, another planet just like ours, that is perhaps also populated with people who are wondering the same thing. With tools such as NASA's Kepler Space Observatory, astronomers have been able to confirm the existence of about 3,500 extrasolar planets or worlds beyond our own solar system. A few of these alien worlds have been described as being Earth-like in nature. A couple of the planets resemble our Earth so much that some scientists have labeled them as Earth 2.0. Today, we'll discuss the discovery of extrasolar or exoplanets, the hunt for our planet's twin or Earth 2.0, and perhaps someday finding extraterrestrial intelligent life. We'll also talk about NASA's Kepler spacecraft, its initial planet-hunting mission, and its latest mission called K2. My guest for my first segment is Lisa Kaltenegger. She is the director of the Carl Sagan Institute and an associate professor of astronomy at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. The Carl Sagan Institute, named after the late and legendary scientist and science communicator, was founded in 2015 at Cornell University with a goal to explore other worlds within and outside of our solar system. Professor Kaltenegger, I've heard the term Earth 2.0 whenever an exoplanet that resembles our planet is discovered. Could you give us your definition of Earth 2.0?
Well, the most impressive thing, or the really fascinating thing in our time, is that we have found thousands of planets orbiting alien suns. And among those, we have about 36 that are small enough, so a rock like the Earth, that's one of the conditions, because a huge gaseous Jupiter is not likely to have any life. And they're at the right distance from their star, from the alien sun, that it's not too hot and not too cold. And what I mean by that is if you have water on the surface of a rocky planet, if you're too close to the hot star, that water will evaporate. So basically a steam atmosphere, and then it's going to escape into space. If you're too far away, it gets so cold that everything freezes out and you're like a frozen wasteland. But we have already about 36 detected alien worlds, if you want, that actually are fitting this criteria. They are small enough, so they're rock from everything we know, and they're at the right distance. And that's where the really, really interesting fascination comes in. And then you can call it Earth 2.0, or you can, better, I think, call it just another habitable world, because I personally think that most likely there's going to be a huge diversity out there, what makes this search even more interesting than if we only found Earth's analog planets out there.
Something I've been curious about, Lisa, is how scientists are able to get so much information about these planets that are so far away. Information like its structure and if it has water.
So the interesting thing is we can do this for these hot Jupiters already, right? Because those hot Jupiters are big planets with lots of gas in their atmosphere. And so there's a lot of light that filters through that air, through that gassy atmosphere in a huge giant planet. But for the small ones that could be like the Earth, we don't have any light yet. What that means is we don't have that information yet. We haven't read the fingerprint, the spectral fingerprint of those planets yet, but we know from the big giant Jupiters, the hot ones, how to do it. And now we're building the telescopes that'll be able to do it. And the other question you ask, how do we know about anything like structure? We kind of know, well, the one thing we know is the mean density. And what I mean by that is like if you had a huge bathtub, and you would throw Saturn in and the Earth would sink because it's a rock, but Saturn would swim because its mean density is lower than water. And that's what we have for the exoplanets as well, or for about like a lot of those exoplanets, not all of them, but most. Because we get their radius in case they block out light from the star in the transit methods, right? Because if they go between us and the star, we see the star a little less brighter. This is how the NASA mission Kepler finds planets, but also other telescopes from the ground. And then the second way that we find and planets is we look at them and we see whether the star wobbles back and forth because the planet tugs on it. Like when you walk in a park and a dog tugs on you, wants to go that direction, you lean back to keep it where you want it to be. And so when we look at the star, we can see them wobble. That gives us an idea about how massive the planet is. And if the planet goes between our line of sight to the star, so the star becomes a little bit dimmer frequently whenever the planet actually goes between us and the star, then you can say what the mean density is and you can compare it to Earth and you can compare it to Saturn. And this is when you're figuring out, is this a rocky planet that could be an Earth 2.0? Or is this something much more akin to a super hot, great, gaseous new world? You know, so it's kind of a really interesting trade-off even there, because we're finding planets we never thought could exist. Because in our solar system, we have this nice innermost four rocky planets, really nice and small, and the outermost four big gaseous planets, right? But we have nothing in between. And what we're finding out there is kind of everything in between, what is fascinating to watch and hopefully decipher in the near future.
In our solar system, as you just mentioned, we have rocky planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Earth, and the remaining four gas planets. In research in discovering exoplanets, have scientists found a planet type other than rocky or gassy?
Oh, absolutely. Because the really interesting thing is this was when the first planet was discovered in 1995 around the Sun-like star. People actually said it couldn't exist. There was no way, because we looked at our solar system and we said, okay, a star is hot. Makes a lot of sense, right? So if you form a planet close to a star, you've evaporated off, because it's just so hot in that environment, all the ice and gas. So the only thing you have left is rock. So the planets close to the star are rocky. And then if you're far enough away, it gets cold enough that the ice doesn't evaporate anymore. So those planets actually become really big ones because they have ice, gas, and rock as a mixture. And the first planet they found, 51 Pegasus b, is actually a Jupiter in a 4.5-day orbit, means Monday to Friday afternoon, right? And so people said, no, that couldn't exist. That wasn't possible because it was too close. And then we figured out, just from that first discovery and from many, many more after that, that our idea of how planets forms are just wasn't complete. Because planets can move after they formed, and that's what happened to the 51 Peg, the first one we found, and that's what happens to a lot of planets out there. So we're finding such a diversity in different kind of planets. We find something that we call mini Neptune, smaller than Neptune, or super Earth, bigger than Earth. So it's in this gap in our own solar system. We have nothing that's rocky and bigger than the Earth, and nothing that's smaller than Neptune. And so basically this mini Neptune and super Earth is a completely new kind of planets that we don't know anything about, really, except for what we can glean from these exciting new discoveries. So I'd say our view of what planets can be and what worlds are out there is starting to get better and better and more complete, and it has lots of interesting surprises.
When we talk about the discovery of an exoplanet, many folks think about NASA's Kepler Space Observatory. But I understand that there are a couple of land-based observatories that have been planet-hunting as well, because they have special instruments attached to their telescopes. I think perhaps they're located at the European Southern Observatory in Chile, as well as the Subaru and Keck telescopes atop Mauna Loa in Hawaii.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of really innovative ways trying to use the biggest telescopes from the ground to do exoplanet discoveries. And they've yielded, for example, the TRAPPIST-1 system, the one that was just in the news. It's a fascinating system. It's like seven rocky planets around a very, very tiny star. The tiny star only has about 5% the brightness of our own sun. So those planets are very close to it, but they have to be to stay nice and warm. And so from the ground, it's basically a question, what can you spot? And if the star is very small, then a planet that transits it, right, that goes around it and blocks your view of it, if you have a big star, the planet needs to be very big for you to spot it. But if you have a small star, a small planet can like block out quite some of the surface of the small star. And this is a trick, a really intelligent trick that observers from the ground are using. They are focusing on the smallest stars, and there's lots of them, but they're focusing exclusively, in a way, on the smallest stars to find such planets, because this is where, even from the ground, you can get enough signal to find them. And so that has been a great, great, great addition to all this search from Kepler, as you were saying. And you do this on any big telescope that you can, as long as you have an instrument that can spot such transits or that can block out the starlight and find direct image planets. And there's a lot of interesting discoveries, as you said, from the ground. And especially this TRAPPIST-7, this TRAPPIST-1 system that just came out is a great, great example, because we have for the first time three planets within what we talked about before, the Goldilocks zone. And if you include volcanism, that's just a new paper we have out, if you include volcanism, even the outermost one could be warm and nice and not a frozen wasteland. So you might even have four habitable, potentially habitable worlds, warm and nice places around the star. What's amazing, because I think if you just imagine standing on any of those and looking up in the sky and have maybe even a few or three other habitable worlds, that would just be outstanding.
If you don't mind, Lisa, could you fill us in on that recent Cornell study about hydrogen flowing from volcanic sources and how it could improve locating life in the cosmos?
Oh, absolutely. So my colleague Ramses Ramirez and me, we were thinking about a planet, right? And so what basically happens is if you go further and further away from the star, a planet like the Earth that has volcanoes would have more and more CO2 in its atmosphere. That's a greenhouse gas, so it keeps it warm. But there's other things that come out of volcanoes too. And we looked into this in more detail, and what we realized is that hydrogen is also coming out of volcanoes if there's an eruption. And there's actually quite a lot of hydrogen that can come out. And hydrogen is actually a great warming agent. So it can actually trap heat very efficiently, and it can increase the effect that CO2 has in warming, because it just broadens the lines, so trapping more heat. So we were actually thinking, hey, this is something that nobody has taken into account. And then when we did the numbers, when we have big atmospheric models to figure out how these planets could be like, we realized that this edge of the habitable zone, the outer one, where then we thought everything would be like a frozen wasteland and we couldn't pick up signatures of life anymore, again, because there's this ice layer on top of a potential ocean where there could be life or something, that is actually about 50% further out. And that is great, because that gives us so much more space around the star where you can look for a habitable world. And the further away the planet is from the star, the easier it is to spot it in things like direct imaging, for example. So that also adds to the excitement of the study. And last but not least is if you actually put a lot of hydrogen in an atmosphere, hydrogen is a very light gas. So you puff up the atmosphere a little. And if you puff up the atmosphere a little, it just becomes easier to spot any signatures or any other chemical in the atmosphere, the chemical makeup. And so whether or not such planets exist, they should exist. We don't have one in our own solar system. And I think this is why people had never thought about it, right? Because we have Mars, and then we have the asteroid belt, and then we have Jupiter. So if we had had a planet after Mars, we probably would have thought about this a long time ago, but we don't. So looking at other systems and getting inspired that way of what could happen or how they could be like helped in this kind of creative thinking process. And then they just discovered TRAPPIST-1, or announced TRAPPIST-1 very funnily the week before, and we're like, perfect, because TRAPPIST-1H was considered to not be in the habitable zone and be this icy wasteland. But with this extension of the habitable zone out, so basically if there's volcanoes like on an early Earth, if there or on an early Mars, if there's lots of volcanoes on this planet, it could also be nice and warm, and it shouldn't be discarded for the search for life. What just makes the system even more interesting, because now you have four potentially habitable worlds instead of just three.
When we're talking about the search for alien life out in the cosmos, what are scientists expecting to find? Humanoid creatures? Microbes? I guess you have to use your imagination as to what the possibilities might be.
What do scientists expect? I think we don't really have an expectation. I think that's what I would say. I think from all the movies and books, and so we kind of always have actors who have to play these aliens, right? So we kind of very trimmed to expect two eyes, two arms, two legs, and so on. With CGI, it's getting better. But I think we don't know what to expect because evolution of the Earth, if you just look in the depths of the oceans, what amazing creatures there are. And if you wouldn't know that they're from our ocean, somebody showed you a picture of some of the deep sea world creatures, you would think that they are not from this planet. But they are, because evolution just adapted them perfectly to the conditions they live in. So I think what we're trying to do is to take all this huge diversity of life on the Earth and use it as an input in trying to spot life on other planets. But if you go fast forward into the future, I think when you beam down to a surface, if you can, hopefully in the future at one point, the kinds of life that you'll find will very likely be unlike anything you expected.
Speaking of searching for extraterrestrial life, I understand Cornell's Carl Sagan Institute, which you are director of, is taking an interdisciplinary approach to find ET. You have experts in areas such as Earth and atmospheric science, mechanical and aerospace engineering, chemical and biomolecular engineering, agriculture and life science, civil and environmental engineering, and even veterinary medicine.
Absolutely. So one of the key points for me is that this search for life around other planets, so this trying to understand planets like our own by looking at many different alien worlds, that needs an interdisciplinary approach. And what I mean is there is, like, as an astronomer, I can answer all those questions. The biologists have to tell me, you know, ooh, this life could survive under these conditions and could have these signatures or these gases breathe in and out. The chemist has to say, well, and if these gases come into the atmosphere, that's what the chemical reactions would be. And then the engineers say, well, this is how we could detect them, and so on and so forth. So for me, it's crucial, and this is why we built the Carl Sagan Institute here at Cornell, to look at this idea of searching in the solar system for life and outside through a lens of many different disciplines, because this is how you can piece together such a fascinating but also intrinsically complicated puzzle like life on another world. And so far, it has been great fun.
Dr. Lisa Kaltenegger is the director of the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Lisa, thank you so much for taking time to bring us up to date on exoplanets and the search for Earth 2.0.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA or send us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Today, we're discussing the discovery of extrasolar or exoplanets, the hunt for our planet's twin or Earth 2.0, and perhaps someday finding extraterrestrial intelligent life. We're also talking about NASA's Kepler spacecraft, its initial planet-hunting mission, and its latest mission called K2. My guest in this segment is Jessie Dodson. She is the Kepler 2 project scientist at NASA's Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California. Jessie, can you give us a bit of a background on the original Kepler mission?
Kepler originally launched in 2009, and its main goal was to find exoplanets. And we really wanted to understand how common are exoplanets, how common are planets that are similar in size to Earth, and at a bigger level, just how common are exoplanets, period. And kind of to put that in perspective, it's almost hard to remember. 2009 doesn't seem like that long ago, but when we launched, exoplanets were still precious. Every exoplanet was newsworthy and interesting and exciting. And now, thanks to Kepler, we know there are more exoplanets than stars.
And when you're talking about exoplanet, of course, that's short for extrasolar, meaning any planet discovered outside our own solar system.
Exactly.
Now, when you mentioned 2009 as the launch date, when did the space telescope go into service?
So we had a commissioning period of about 60 days as we were testing our equipment and our camera and making sure everything was calibrated. And so it went into commission. We launched in March of 2009. We were taking full-on science observations by the summer.
Before Kepler went into service, how were exoplanets found?
So the most common way to find exoplanets before Kepler was what we call the radial velocity method, where you observe the star, and if you see the star wobble a little bit, then you think there's an exoplanet there, because what you're seeing is you're seeing the star wobble because of the gravitational pull of the planet as it goes around the star.
Now, how was the spacecraft equipped for this mission?
Kepler uses a different method to observe exoplanets. Our spacecraft is basically a huge camera. We are a 94.5 megapixel camera. With that camera, in the original mission, we stared at the same set of stars in the same part of the sky for almost continuously for 4 years. It's taking a photo essentially every 30 minutes. While I say it's a camera that is very, very precise about measuring how bright something is. And what we do is we monitor 150,000 stars, and we look for little teeny tiny changes in their brightness. And if they get dimmer for a little while and then go back to their normal brightness, we go, that looks interesting. And then we wait for that to happen. And if it happens again and again, by the time it gets to the third time, we're like, there's something there. And that dimming is due to a planet passing in between us and its host star. So we're essentially monitoring the star's brightness. And when the planet blocks some of the star's light, we can see that.
It seems to be a goal of astronomers to search for what is being called Earth 2.0, or an exact copy of Earth. Tell us about Kepler discoveries of exoplanets that could be considered to be Earth 2.0.
As an astronomer, I think that one of the things that I like to push back a little bit about Earth 2.0 is, what do you mean by Earth 2.0? You know, I'm a 40-something woman. If you want to find Jessie 2.0, can you find any 40-something woman on the street and call her Jessie 2.0? No, you can't. There's so many details that go into what do you really mean by Earth 2.0. And so we have found quite a few planets or other stars that are similar in size to Earth. We have something like over 500 planets that are similar in size to Earth. Do those count as Earth 2.0? Well, not really. Some of those are much, much hotter than Earth, and some of those are much, much colder than Earth. So then you have to say, okay, so let's find the ones that are at a similar temperature to Earth. And that's what we call the habitable zone. That doesn't mean they are inhabited, but it means they have a temperature so that they could be habitable. Depending on your model of the habitable zone, you get down to, you know, somewhere like half a dozen to 15 planets that are similar in size to Earth that are at the right distance from their star that liquid water could exist. And as far as finding Earth 2.0, that's as far as we can go right now. We don't yet have the tools to take a look and see, do they have atmospheres like Earth? Do they have compositions like Earth? NASA is designing and getting ready to launch missions that can start to address those questions in the future.
Let's get back to the Kepler mission itself and the subsequent K2 mission. In July 2012 and May of 2013, Kepler spacecraft experienced serious problems that could have doomed the mission completely. Now, what happened to the spacecraft on those two dates?
We have a couple different methods to point a spacecraft, and the equipment on the spacecraft that lets us point it really, really precisely, which we have to do to take our measurements, are called reaction wheels. It takes three reaction wheels to point our spacecraft adequately. In 2012, one of them failed, but we still have three. We can still keep going. In 2013, a second one failed. And at that point, it really was in doubt whether or not we would continue the mission. It looked like the mission was over. And then some very clever spacecraft engineers on our team at Ball Aerospace figured out that because of the shape of our spacecraft and which two wheels we had left, we could still point with two wheels. And the way we do that is our spacecraft is very symmetrical. It's got solar panels that kind of are almost like in a V shape. And we point those solar panels at the sun and make sure that that corner of the V is pointed directly at the sun. We are essentially using the solar pressure to balance our spacecraft in one dimension. That's hard to imagine, I know, but here's the analogy. If you've ever seen like a river kayaker can turn their boat around and point upstream, and if they point just right, they can stay there and be really stable because the water rushing on either side of their boat helps keep it pointed. That's essentially what we're doing with our spacecraft, but instead of water rushing past us, it's the photons from the sun rushing past us.
I understand that the continuing K2 mission is actually divided by something called observing campaigns. What's an observing campaign? How long do they usually last? And who determines what will be observed during one of these campaigns?
An observing campaign lasts about 80 days, and it is the length of time we can stare at one part of the sky. And so we kind of plan out our campaigns. We know because of where the spacecraft is and where the sun is, you know, what range we can look at any given period of time. We choose one of those, and then we put out a call for proposals. And any scientist anywhere in the world can write a proposal to NASA and say, for this part of the sky that you're looking at, we think you should download the data on these six objects or these 2,000 objects so that we can do a specific type of science on it.
How many exoplanets have Kepler found so far?
So Kepler has found over 2,000 what we call confirmed planets, and we have over 4,000 additional planets that we call candidates. And the difference in between those two is while these little dips of light I've been talking about are indicative of there being a planet there, there are other possible causes of that. And so we see those dips, and then we do a lot of work to figure out, is it a real planet? Or is something fooling us? And so we've got over 2,000 that we know are real planets. We've got a little over 4,000 that are in the category of we think there's something there, but we haven't ruled out all of the ways we might be fooled yet.
I understand that after a campaign has concluded, data is released. Is it released to the general public? Are citizen scientists involved in finding exoplanets?
Yes, we release the data. Historically, we have gotten the data down from the spacecraft, done our processing on it, pipelined the data, calibrated it, and then we make it public via the Space Telescope Science Institute's data repository. We've also started making the data public as soon as it comes down from the spacecraft, releasing what we call raw data. And at first, we did that not really sure what would happen, but it's turned out to be a resounding success, both in the scientific community and in the citizen science community. So our Campaign 12 data came down at the beginning of March, and it went public on the Space Telescope's MAST website. It's called MAST. And there was a star in there with a known exoplanet system that we thought the K2 data might tell us something new about the seventh planet. This is the TRAPPIST-1 system. And a team of scientists jumped on that raw data right away. And 60 hours later, they had submitted a paper to Nature. They determined, really nailed down how long it took the outer planet to go around the star, which is something that very much interests scientists. So from a scientist's perspective, that's phenomenal to go that quickly from raw data to a scientific result. But there's another piece to this story, which is a stargazing, which is a show in Australia, has been working with a citizen science group out of the Zooniverse called Exoplanet Explorers. My understanding is they did a show, talked about finding exoplanets, and using this Campaign 12 data, they have it packaged in a way for citizen scientists to actually go through and look and find planets in that data. And 2 days later, they have found a host of planets. There's one system that people are really excited about. It's a star similar to our sun. It's got four kind of super Earth planets, kind of about twice the size of Earth, orbiting their star really close in, closer in to their star than Mercury is to our star. And there are scientists who are already starting to write the paper on that. And my understanding is that the citizen scientists who helped them find that planet are going to be co-authors.
How long is the K2 mission expected to last?
That is an excellent question, and if anyone knows the answer, I'd love to know it. No. No, in all seriousness, we have approval from NASA headquarters to keep operating as long as our spacecraft keeps working. So Kepler spacecraft was designed to last 3.5 years. Well, we launched in 2009, so we are way past our expiration date. The spacecraft is continuing to operate fine. We expect we're going to run out of fuel, our most likely failure point. We're not sure when that's going to happen. It might be 12 months from now. It might be 18 months from now. But we're going to keep taking great science with it for as long as we can.
Jesse Dodson, the Kepler K2 project scientist at NASA's Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California. Thank you so much for taking time to tell us about NASA's Kepler and K2 mission and the search for worlds beyond our own solar system.
My pleasure.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank both of our guests for joining us today, as well as our studio technicians, Justin Thwaites and Jonah Cummings. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.